Good morning. You know, I was somewhat confused. I was hoping to be able to sit through Cheryl's lesson on Tuesday when all the gals come over to hear what she's prepared. But she says no men allowed. I can't figure out why. She's been preaching at me for 30-some years. I don't know why I couldn't be there, but anyway, I guess I shouldn't. Lord said so, so we'll go with that. This is our second installment of our study dealing with the Christian and the government. Perhaps you recall last time we looked at several passages, but probably the main one that we would deal with is Romans chapter 13. If you want to turn there, that's where we'll again center a good deal of our study. The Christian and the government. There are some with some ideas regarding a Christian's role or place with reference to government, governmental matters, whether it be a local government or the federal government or state government, doesn't matter. Some contend and are convinced that they can have nothing to do with the government. But that goes both ways. If a person concludes that they can have nothing to do with the government, then why don't they conclude that the government can have nothing to do with them? Now, some try to make it that way, but obviously they get themselves into a lot of trouble when they try to be consistent that way. And especially with reference to the idea of serving in the government, people will come to one conclusion, but since the Bible teaches about the Christian in the government, if they conclude they can't be of governmental service and have nothing to do with it, then they should be able to also use the scripture to justify the government not having anything to do with them, and they can't do it. Again, they find themselves in a heap of trouble if they try to maintain and stand upon their rights. Wait a minute. Where do rights come from? Stand upon their rights that the government has no say over me. Really? Who said that? It certainly wasn't the government that said that. It wasn't God who said that. But this second portion that we're going to deal with this morning is dealing with the subject of capital punishment. What is the Christian's point of view? Now, there are, obviously, with reference to the subject of capital punishment, a person's view, attitude, involvement in these matters, and these are legal matters, some of it will enter the realm of conscience. And we'll get to that when we get to it. But, well, I'll wait till we get to that part before I say anything else. We want to ask the question and answer it, I hope we'll be able to. What does the Bible teach about capital punishment? What is the Christian's part in that? What should we think about it? The beginning of capital punishment is the text that Steve read for us in Genesis chapter 9. I want to look just at verse 6. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. This was God's original idea of capital punishment. And by that we mean a punishment for a capital crime. Capital punishment is the death penalty. And so when we're talking about capital crimes, we're talking about crimes that are so heinous that the only just way to pay for that would be for one to forfeit their life. That's how bad it is. But there is this strange idea about life. You know, for the most part, people in our culture are afraid to talk about death. They're afraid to talk about it. And yet death is just a normal part of our lives. We face death all the time. We obviously need to be prepared for it. But some are just so concerned when they talk about cancer that they'll whisper the word. Or, you know, this person had a heart attack. Or they've got some other dread disease or something. These are facts of life, brethren. I don't mean to be crude and coarse here, but we need to face them. We need to be aware of them so that we can properly prepare for them and have a healthy attitude towards them. That doesn't mean we have a flippant attitude, but a healthy attitude towards them. Well, the same is true with reference to capital punishment. Sometimes, as I say, people have such a strange view of life that the taking of any life is just unthinkable in their minds. Ooh, it's just a gross idea. That's because people have divorced themselves from the idea of death in our cultured society, in our antibiotic world, and our, you know, don't, whatever you do, don't let germs get on your hands. You shake hands with somebody, quick, squirt something on there and rub your hands. Don't let the children play on that carpet. The dog was sitting there just a minute ago. And just in my judgment, just my opinion, kind of a fetish about germs and antiseptic society we live in. Consequently, we've forgotten how to look at death properly. Some have looked at life in an unrealistic way. After the flood, of course, is when this was being taught. This is Genesis chapter 9, right after the flood. This is what he's been telling Noah and his family. And he's from the outset, here comes a human family beginning to reproduce and fill the earth again. And one of the first things he tells them is the sanctity of life. And if somebody takes life, that life must be required of them. The first principle here is protect the innocent. That's the first principle of God's ruling on capital punishment. And the second principle is take the life of the life taker. By the way, because of that, that legitimizes the first principle. Murder is so extreme and so heinous that the only justice for it is to take the life of the life taker. This is God's point of view. And so basically, I've already answered the question, haven't I? What is the Christian's point of view of capital punishment? But there's so much more we want to consider. So here's a question. If life is so precious, then why should we take the life of the life taker? There are three answers to this, probably more, but I'm going to suggest that there's three answers to this. Is that in focus? Yeah, that looks okay. Number one, and always the first answer, is because God said so. He has legislated it. And that should satisfy us, although it doesn't, for the most part. Number two, because it serves as a deterrent. Here's where the debate starts. It serves as a deterrent. Those who are opposed to capital punishment say, no, it doesn't. Those who are in favor of capital punishment says, yes, it does. Now, there's been a number of different topics through the years of my preaching here and everywhere else that I've ever been, that there have been a number of topics that I've dealt with where I thought, well, these statistics are, these are the bee's knees. I'll include these numbers in these statistics. I've tried to shy away from that in more recent years because statistics can be cooked. They can present all sorts of things. I think statistics are a good thing, and they perhaps can give us a good measure on certain matters, but statistics don't always tell the tale. So I'd rather just reserve my thinking on this subject to what God has said about it. It does serve as a deterrent according to what we read in the Scriptures. Here's one. It's a lengthy reading. I do think we ought to take time at least to look at it because it sets in motion a principle. This, by the way, is under the time of the law. Genesis 9 was under the time of patriarchy. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. This is under the law in Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning at verse 58. Here's what the law was said about this. And it's a word of warning. If thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that thou mayest fear this glorious and fearful name, Jehovah thy God, then Jehovah will make thy plagues wonderful. That doesn't mean good. That means it's a marvel. It's a wonder. Oh, how can this be happening? And the plagues of thy seed, even great plagues, and of long continuance, and sore sicknesses, and of long continuance. This is a word of warning, you see. Obey my law, because you won't like the consequences. And he will bring upon thee again all the diseases of Egypt, which thou wast afraid of, and shall cleave unto thee. Also, every sickness and every plague which is not written in the book of this law, them will Jehovah bring upon thee until thou be destroyed. This is a death sentence. And ye shall be left few in number, whereas ye were as the stars of heaven for multitude, because thou didst not hearken unto the voice of Jehovah thy God. And it shall come to pass that as Jehovah rejoiceth over you to do good and to multiply you, so Jehovah will rejoice over you to cause you to perish and to destroy you. And ye shall be plucked from off the land whither thou goest in to possess it. And Jehovah will scatter thee among all the peoples, from the one end of the earth even to the other end of the earth. Thou shalt serve other gods which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, even wood and stone. And that came to pass, didn't it? And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, and there shall be no rest for the sole of thy foot, but Jehovah will give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and pining of soul. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear night and day, and shalt have no assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, were it were even. And at evening thou shalt say, were it were morning, for the fear of thy heart which thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see. Capitalize on that word fear. In the law, God said, obey my law. If you don't, you're going to have all the diseases that are just dreadful things you've never even heard of. Going to scatter you to the four winds. You're going to have to live in the land of other peoples and serve their gods, and you won't like it. Be afraid. Capital punishment, according to that particular passage, is a deterrent because it brings fear. Job chapter 19, verse 29. Be afraid of the wrath of the sword and its punishments, because the sword brings judgment. That's what Job said in chapter 19, verse 29 of his treatise. It serves as a deterrent. We'll continue this thought. Jeremiah 2 and verse 12, again, the prophet said, be afraid due to disobedience. And the fear there is the fear of death because of what God has promised. Now, here's an interesting question. Here we are in Mount Carmel. Remember, there's God's prophet against the 450 prophets of Baal. There's a contest. Y'all remember that, right? Well, at the beginning of this contest, 1 Kings 18 and verse 21, this is what the people said. What made the people change their point of view and change their ideas and their thinking? In 1 Kings 18, 21, when he said, why go ye limping or halting between two opinions? If Jehovah is God, then serve him. If Baal is God, then serve him. And the people answered not a word. That is, they were indifferent. They're standing there. I can almost see it now in my own mind's eye. They're standing there saying, so prove your point here. Why are you asking us this? This isn't important. When the contest was over and the prophets of Baal saw that their god Baal was not God, but that God destroyed their altar and their offering and even licked up the water in the trench that surrounded it and so on, destroyed their, consumed that which Elijah prepared for them. Now the people saw what happened in verse 39. They said, Jehovah, he is God. Jehovah, he is God. What a change of attitude from, who cares? This isn't a very important question. And they didn't answer him to, yeah, you're right. Jehovah is God. What changed that? The power of the destruction of God against those who oppose him. It was a fear of death. And incidentally, what happened to those prophets of Baal? They saw what happened there too, didn't they? That is, God's prophet hacked them to pieces. The third answer, why is capital punishment important? Because it's necessary. Number three, it's necessary to remove evil from society and protect the innocent. God requires life for life. And friends, he does so through the agency of men. In the case that we're talking about from Romans 13, he does so through the agency of government. Capital punishment is never to be used as personal vengeance, although I'm afraid that probably in some places it is. People are being put to death simply to protect one's position or some other form of personal vengeance. Have you been watching the news? What's going on in Iran, in Tehran right now? What's happening there and why? Well, I'm not sure that can be considered capital punishment, but people are dying there to protect something. Somebody's wreaking vengeance to save their own skin. This is contrary to what God says. Remember Romans 12, verse 19, when he says, avenge not yourselves, beloved, but give place unto the wrath of God, because it is written, vengeance belongeth unto me, and I shall recompense. He's the one who's going to pay it back. So why should we have this view of capital punishment? God said so, serves as a deterrent, and it helps protect the innocent and removes evil from our society. Ordination does not guarantee perfection. Now, what do I mean by this? I mean by this that just because something has been ordained of God doesn't mean that they're going to act always according to what God has taught. For example, this is true of elders, it's true of deacons, it's true of fathers, it's true of husbands. I suppose I could say it's true of wives and mothers as well. But I'll leave it here on our shoulders, men. Just because we have been given a certain place of authority in our homes as husbands and fathers doesn't mean we're going to execute that office perfectly, does it? We're going to make mistakes. We're going to do things probably we shouldn't do as dads and as husbands. Well, that's true of the government as well. The government is ordained of God. But not all governments are going to give heed to what God desires. In Romans chapter 13, verses 3 and 4, this passage speaks to us concerning fear of the power. Now, the power is that which the government wields, and we are to fear or respect that. Literally, to be afraid of it. And we've already talked about why. There are two reasons, because of wrath and conscience. We discussed that last time. We are to respect and be afraid, because if we do wrongly, then the fear of death will serve to deter and repay. The death penalty is a deterrent. God said so. He made that very clear. I believe, from the statistics that I've been able to read, that it is a deterrent as well. Some will argue that point. But we can't argue against what God says about it. Capital punishment is just and righteous. I know that because God is the one who endorsed it. Now back to Genesis 9 verse 6. If anyone sheds man's blood, by man his blood should be shed. Now, some have concluded that this was simply temporary injunction that God put on Noah and his family. And it's under the law of patriarchy, or it's under the time of patriarchy, where the fathers were the heads of the house, and they were the, so to speak, the priests between them and God. God spake unto the fathers in diverse portions and diverse ways, Hebrews 1 verse 1. And so here's a time of patriarchy, and some people conclude, well, that was just temporary. So we know it was then, but it was also under the law of Moses. Capital punishment was set out in the law of Moses in such books as Deuteronomy, Exodus. 1 Samuel 15 is a great example of capital punishment. It was in force while Jesus was on the earth. How do we know that? Because in John chapter 19, verses 10 and 11, Jesus even was threatened. He says, what, don't you know that I have power to release you or power to crucify you? What did Jesus say to that? You wouldn't have any power if it wasn't given to you from above. Remember that? What did Jesus teach him just then? What was he teaching Pilate then? That your authority comes from God. I know you have power to crucify me, and you'll do what you decide is best, but your power comes from God. Even under the time of Christianity, under the new law, under the gospel, the law of Christ, in Acts chapter 25 and verse 11, Paul there is talking to Festus about some things, and the Jews have brought some false charges against him. And he said, well, do you want to go to Jerusalem and have these charges put to the test? He says, absolutely not. These charges are false, and no one can deliver me over to them. Now watch verse 11. He says, if I have done something worthy of death, I refuse not to die. What was Paul admitting there? The death penalty is a viable punishment for something worthy of death. So from patriarchy to the law of Moses, while Jesus was on the earth, even under the law of Christ, capital punishment was not a temporary thing that God enjoined upon men. It's something that men have practiced all through the ages. But let's keep in mind, unauthorized killing is never valid. God has no pleasure in death. Did you know that? The prophet Ezekiel says it twice, in chapter 18 and chapter 33. I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Even of the wicked, he doesn't have pleasure in their death. He would prefer that they would change their ways and repent. God would have all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 4. He's not willing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9. But nevertheless, God demands life for the life taker. Because taking life is killing God by proxy. Taking life, murder, not killing, murder, and there's a difference, we'll discuss it, is killing God by proxy. You know what a proxy is? It's a substitute, it's a stand-in. How is it that murdering someone is killing God by proxy? You probably know the answer. Because all men were created in the image of God. One man's hatred for another to the point where he just wants to kill him, even if he never lifts a finger, John says is murder. 1 John chapter 3. And you know no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. The point of hatred to the point of taking another man's life out of anger or vengeance or greed or, you know, you name the subject. The reason, the motive, is because of one's disdain for God, what God has said. God demands life for the life taker. How do we oppose the phase of God's righteous wrath and judgment? I don't understand how a person can oppose it when God has authorized it. So, what about capital punishment? The punishment must fit the crime. We need to understand this. Because if the punishment is too light, it really serves no good. On the big thing on the news right now, this guy in, where was that? Was that in Oklahoma? Oklahoma. This man raped a 5-year-old girl in front of her 6-year-old brother and then raped him too. This man has been convicted on these kinds of things before. He was out on parole when he did this. And guess what? That's all he got. 1 year in jail. If the punishment is too light, it's really not going to serve anything. But if it's too heavy, we can run into tyranny. I still see the pictures from an email that was sent to me some time back about a little 8-year-old boy in one of those Eastern nations. I don't know if it was either Iraq or Iran. It was a Muslim nation who had grabbed a piece of fruit on a stand and ran off and was eating it. They caught him. And so here's all these big guys, these men, holding this little boy down on the ground and stretched his arm out so that a truck could roll over his elbow and crush that little joint, this little 8-year-old boy. Now, does that seem like the kind of punishment that that little child deserved? That's tyranny. That's terrorism. That's not justice. So, too light's no good. Too heavy, tyranny. Taking the life of the life taker shows the value of human life. What does the Bible teach? Let's start back at the beginning. Here's Cain and Abel, the first murder ever to take place. And we have this question. How did Cain know that others were going to be seeking his life? Remember what God's judgment was here in Genesis 4, verses 13 and 14? If not, look at it. He says, all right, that's it for you. From now on, you're going to be a stranger and a soldier, a vagabond in the earth. Your crops aren't going to yield. Nothing's going to work for you. And he said, this punishment's too great for me. Everywhere I go, people are going to be seeking to take my life. How did he know that? Why did he conclude that others would take his life because of his crime of murdering his brother? There was something we're not told, but I'll bet you that Cain must have been told something. How awful this crime was. Taking the life of the life taker. Under the law of Moses, there are four categories for capital punishment, and here they are. For civil disobedience, for religious disobedience or blasphemy, for sexual immorality, and other forms of moral crimes, such as cursing your parents, being disobedient. Various other things were capital crimes. What does the Bible teach about under the law of Christ? We've already looked at Acts 25 and verse 11. Paul says, listen, if I've done something worthy of death, I don't refuse to die. I realize that's my just punishment. That's what he was saying. In 1 Peter 2 and verse 14, Peter is telling us as Christians to behave and live properly under our various forms of government, whether it's a king or a president or governors. Now look at this, verse 14, who have been sent to punish evildoers. Evildoers deserve punishment, and the government is in charge of that, Peter says. Chapter 4, verse 15, let none of you suffer as, and they list several things, and one of those is as a murderer, or an evildoer, or a murderer, because murderers need to suffer. And we already know what the punishment is for murder, according to what God says. At one time, you know, civil and spiritual government were all one, such as under the law of Moses. Their religion was their government as well. It's called a theocracy. In the first century, God saw fit to separate these two. Their civil government and their spiritual government. The Christian is bound to both of them, according to various texts of the New Testament, particularly Romans 13. In the civil aspect of our lives, we are bound to the government. The government has control. In the spiritual aspects of our lives, the government is not to trifle with that, though not all governments do that. Not even our government. Our government will sometimes try to dabble in spiritual matters and either prevent or some other way regulate spiritual activity. And they've got no business doing so, but they'll do it anyway. Under the spiritual realm, there where we live, there's the local church, a local congregation. Maybe there's elders. If there's not elders, then it's the congregation's leadership of that time, that place. Typically, we would refer to it as the men's business meeting and the authority that they wield to make decisions for the congregation, all in keeping with what God teaches. But both of these, civil and spiritual, belong to Christ. What did Jesus say in Matthew 28 and verse 18? All authority in heaven and on earth belongeth unto me. See, he's the one in charge of both of those realms. So when we're obeying Christ, we're obeying the government. When we're obeying the government, we're obeying Christ. So here's a question. How do we bring these two together? What about the Christian and the government, particularly in the subject of capital punishment? I believe the best answer is Romans chapter 13. Here's a question. May, please notice may here. May a Christian be an agent of the state, take a life, be a soldier or a policeman, be on a jury for capital crime, vote for the death penalty, be a judge, or as a judge, sentence someone to death? May a Christian do that? Keep in mind, I'm not saying that a Christian must do those things. The question is simply, may a Christian do those things? Well, let's look at some things before we answer the question. Here's the simplest answer. All actions that are authorized as a ministry or agent of God are morally correct. If God authorizes it, it has to be morally correct. Has to be. Well, guess what? All morally correct actions may be, and some must be, supported by Christians. In other words, a Christian may serve on a jury. Their conscience may dismiss them. But all Christians must pay taxes. You must. It's the law. God says do so. Here's an important syllogism. I offered it last week. Here it is again, just as a reminder. All institutions ordained by God are morally correct. Government is an institution ordained by God, according to Romans 13. Therefore, the government is morally correct and is morally correct in all that it is authorized to do. One of the things it's authorized to do is practice capital punishment. Furthermore, all morally correct institutions may be participated in by Christians. If they're moral, we can be a part of it. The government is a morally correct institution. Therefore, Christians may participate in the government and all that the government is authorized to do, because they're sanctioned by God. Here's an example. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 4 through 10. Take a look there. We're going to be looking at the passages and some certain words that we find there. So if you want, turn along, take a look for 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 4 through 10. Here's the second coming of Christ and so on. We've studied from time to time. But we want to highlight a few things from the verses. In verse number 4, he speaks of persecutions and afflictions. Okay, verse 5. God's righteous judgment. Underline that word righteous. Verse 6, it's a righteous thing to recompense affliction, to pay back. It's a righteous thing. Verse 7, Jesus is going to be revealed, but when he does, there's going to be not only rest for some, but fire for the others when Jesus comes back. Continuing on with this text, verse 8, vengeance is mentioned. Verse 9, punishment and destruction, eternal destruction, forever. Verse 10, glory and people marveling at the Lord. So, on the one hand, here's what we've got. Persecution, affliction, judgment, fire, vengeance, punishment, destruction. Things that are not too pleasant sounding, are they? But on the other hand, there's righteousness and a righteous thing, a righteous action of God. There's rest, there's glory, there's marvel. How do we reconcile these two things? In the same text, here's the answer. It is right for God to pay back evil. It is right for God to pay vengeance. Hell will be a righteous judgment. And those who conclude God is too much of a loving God to ever send anyone to hell have not thought this through. Hell's not unfair and unjust. It's a righteous judgment of God. He said so. Now here comes the objection. This is usually the objection that I hear from this. Quote, but that's not our God's doing. That's God's doing, not ours. That's what he's going to do. Well, that's true. I mean, I'm not in charge of hell. He is. But the answer to that is, let's be careful that we don't deny the doctrine of agency. Sometimes God accomplishes his work through the agency of men. We've just been studying this on Wednesday nights, remember? We're talking about providence and our blessings and so on. Some of those come by the agency of us doing his will. Others will be blessed by it. Who's blessing these people? God is. But sometimes we're the agency of that blessing. God will punish certain ones. Sometimes it's through the agency of what he has ordained, such as the government. Here's an illustration. Hebrews chapter 7, verses 4 through 9. The text basically is dealing with Melchizedek and Abraham. Melchizedek, the king of righteousness. He's God's priest, high priest. Abraham comes to him and Abraham pays tithes to Melchizedek. There was an offering that was paid to that high priest. And then he says, and besides all that, there is Levi, who is still in the loins of their father Abraham. Well, actually, several generations removed, wasn't it? And what was Levi's task? They're going to serve as priests. What did they deserve as the priesthood of God? They deserved tithes to be paid to them. And yet, so here was one who was not only the one who was to receive tithes, they in turn had to pay tithes. But how did they do so? How did Levi pay tithes to Melchizedek? Through the agency of their grandfather, Abraham. Look at verse 9 closely. And so to say, through Abraham, even Levi, who receiveth tithes, hath paid tithes. If nothing else, brethren, we're illustrating here the doctrine of agency. God requires certain things through agency of someone else. It's sometimes necessary for someone, the government, to take the life of another, such as a life taker. This is righteous work. God has ordained it. It is a moral action. And Christians are authorized to do anything moral. Colossians 3 and verse 17, whatsoever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of, according to, by the authority of Jesus Christ. So, another look at this question. May a Christian be an agent of the state? Take a life? Be a soldier or a policeman? Be on a jury for capital crimes? Vote for the death penalty? Be a judge? And as a judge, sentence someone to death? I believe the biblical answer is yes, they can. Although the Christian is not exempt from this authorized work of government from either direction. Here's what some try to do. This is a very shallow argument. Here's what some try to do. Quote, I'm a Christian. I cannot be an agent of the government. I cannot condone capital punishment. I cannot participate in taking the life of another. The Bible forbids it. Well, that's an assertion, and I believe I've proved that that's not true. The Bible does not forbid it. But they'll say, I'm a Christian, the government, you know, I can't have anything to do with the government. And they'll usually use such passages as Romans 13 to try to prove that. However, the argument or reasoning, and I put that in quotes because it's not a very good one, that they put forth to attempt to prove this should also prove that they could just as easily say this, quote, I'm a Christian, the government has no control over me. It cannot punish me for capital crimes. It cannot take my life. Well, they're in for a big surprise if they do something worthy of death, because the government will take their life if they do their duty. It's false and they know it. Romans 13 proves that both of these statements are false. It is not the case that God forbids you to be a senator, a representative, a mayor, the president. The Bible doesn't forbid a Christian from doing those things. To deny Romans 13 his authority to execute, one or all three of these is going to happen. Somebody says, I deny that there's such a thing as capital punishment. Then one of three things is going to be the case. Number one, they have to conclude that the law of Christ is not for all men. And we know that's not true. Does that mean that there are two laws in force now from God, one for the heathen and one for his people? No. There's not two laws, there's just one. Romans chapter 2 and verse 16 says that God will judge all men by my gospel through Jesus Christ. Number two, some are going to conclude Romans 13 is not a part of the law of Christ. That applies only to the world, not to the Christian. And if that's true, how do we know that maybe Galatians chapter 3 doesn't apply to the world, not to me? How about Hebrews chapter 10? Maybe that doesn't apply to me. That's not really part of the law of Christ. What part can we say is part of the law of Christ and part is not in the New Testament? Number three, they'll have to conclude that punishing evil is not moral. It's immoral to be on the jury. I can't do it. The Bible forbids it. And therefore, I can't be a part of it. But what they've done is imply that God is immoral, because God will punish evil with the death penalty. But we can't conclude that God's immoral. Here's a fact. Sometimes people act like animals, and they are fit only to be destroyed. Now, that sounds pretty harsh, doesn't it? Sometimes just people act like animals, and they're fit only to be destroyed. But those are not my words. Those are the words of 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 12. Peter says, as unreasoning animals, fit only to be taken away and destroyed. That's how some people are. Like this man in Oklahoma, acting like some kind of an animal with those little children. And other such things that we might view as horrendous capital crimes. Here's a summary. God authorizes capital punishment. A Christian may participate in government and its works because it's a moral institution. Such is righteous work and therefore moral if we choose to participate. You don't have to, but you may. But if we do, brethren, keep in mind it's not out of personal vengeance. Don't vote for the death penalty in someone if you're on a jury simply out of means of vengeance personally. But do your duty as a citizen in a desire for justice. This is part of the judicial system God has authorized and our government includes. That is our study for this morning, dealing with the Christian and capital punishment. There is death and destruction waiting for every person who's not a Christian. And so as we're talking about death and punishment, eternal separation from God, let's make this personal. We hope and pray that every person in this house this morning will have the attitude of being willing to be serving to God through His Son Jesus. If you're not a Christian this morning, you need to be. Capital punishment is coming, a form of which is far worse than anything man can dish out. Eternity in hell. If you believe that Jesus is the Son of God and you're willing to make confession of that simple fact, then turn away from your error, turn away from your negligence and your sin, and be obedient to God and obey His gospel, having your sins washed clean in the blood of the Lamb when you're baptized, and He will add you to the church. And then, my friends, continue to live as good citizens of this nation or whatever nation you associate yourself with. Be a good citizen. Observe the government. Pay your specs and your taxes. Perhaps there's someone here this morning who is already a Christian but has had the wrong view of the government. Brother or sister, I hope that you will think this through and be obedient to the government and pay your proper respect. Never cheat on your taxes. It is a sin. It's not just a bad idea. It is a sin. Don't do those things. Maybe you need the prayers of the congregation, need to confess wrong, or simply request prayers. Whatever the case is, we're here to help you. Let us know how we can. Right now, won't you come while we stand and sing this song of encouragement?